Hey everybody, I'm Jazz.
And I'm Molly. And welcome, welcome, welcome to
Wild
Wicked
World.
You guys, we are back.
Hello, hello, hello.
Yeah, we're back after our week hiatus there because Jazz had to go on her, you know, first vacation in the fucking year of her million to come.
It was my first true vacation, though. Like, road trips, I don't really count, but this one I count.
Yeah, she went to Cali.
Went to Disney out there, Universal, went to some beaches.
And she brought me my obligatory magnet and sticker.
I had to make sure the sticker was on the laptop.
You know it is. I know we have a guy at work that's going to Dominican Republic this week for a whole week. And I was like, I told him before he left, I said, I like magnets and stickers. Like,
bring it.
I was like, seriously, though, I'm collecting magnets and stuff. So he's like, I'll bring you one back. So, and I told TC when he goes, he's going to Florida in May to, you know, meet his new great grandchild and stuff. And I told him to bring me a magnet back.
Bring it.
Speaking of that, TC's going to be 70 years old on Monday.
He's a old, old man.
This man's never going to retire, but I'm okay with that because I don't want him to.
Yeah, when he retires, it'll be a day.
Yeah, I think I'm going to try to make him a cake or something to bring. So do a little something.
You
and then,
think?
Well, the Letitia's birthday is also on Wednesday. Mm-hmm. So yeah, got two birthdays coming up this week of two people I care about, so I'm gonna have to do something for both of them.
May is a heavy, it's May, right?
Yeah, and my son, my oldest is gonna be 20 in May as well.
Oh yeah, May, it's a lot of people's birthday. My nephews, both of my nephews' birthdays, my dad's girlfriend, my brothers, my cousin.
Wow, okay.
I'm gonna go broke.
And then you got me in June.
Yeah, it's tough out here.
I know my husband's getting me a kayak for my birthday. That's what I asked for. So I'm excited about that. I'm ready to be able to just pop it on because I found a Rambo at work sent me a thing for a rack for my car. It's only like $40.
Oh,
pop it on my car, boom. I can't wait. So, because right now I always have to borrow Jamie's kayak, which she's always willing to do, but it's just gonna be a lot easier to have my own. So you'll have to, me and you will have to make some kayaking. We can like after we record, we could be like, all right, let's record.
Kayak
then
time.
Let's go out and kayak for
a while. Ready to get out there on the water.
Yes, yes. All right. So what is our Jazz Talk this week?
Oh, pull up your Facebook real quick.
My Facebook.
Huh? Yes. Okay. So for this week, it's going to be you and you're robbing a bank. And the first two people that you add on Facebook are your partners in crime. So who are they?
My best friend, Tiffany Lewis, and my stepdad.
So do you think that you're going to get caught or no? You getting away or?
With Tiffany, I have no doubt that we would get away with it. Now with my stepdad, I'm not quite sure on that one.
Okay. And let's see.
But it's so weird that those two popped up. Like, are those the people that look at my shit the most? Is that why they pop up?
I don't know how that works.
Because you would think that Letitia's like the third one now.
Damn. What could have been? Oh, well, mine are Molly. So we're getting away. And then my sister, Desiree. I'm going to tell you, we might get caught because of...
So we're both screwed then. So we just ditch Jim and Desiree, and we just take Tiffany and me, and we got this. That me and Tiffany, always our joke has always been Bonnie and Clyde. Not Bonnie and Clyde, Thelma and Louise.
Well, let me just be the getaway
driver. We're Thelma and Louise, you know, like we'll go out together, we'll kill ourselves together, fuck the men, fuck everybody else.
Yeah.
So I have no doubt.
We're on that.
She's my investigator anyway. Like if I need somebody to, you know, investigate somebody for me or something, she's my go-to. She's also, you met Tiffany. She's my photographer.
Yeah, Desiree, she can't come. She can't even keep a straight face. She'll turn red. She'll just be looking too guilty. When we were younger and we used to go to Walmart and take things. I was younger. And Desiree would always be the one looking suspicious and guilty. So we were just like, girl, stop looking at the cameras. Stop it. She would just get us called.
That's funny. Come on, we've all done it. Yeah. So I ain't judging you here.
No judgment.
No judgment. No judgment. That's a pretty good one. Yeah. Tiffany and my stepdad. Okay. Mom, tell Jim that he's going to rob a bank with me.
Get ready. Get this.
I know my mom listens, but she's usually few weeks behind.
Yeah.
So like she'll listen to it like 3 weeks.
So she's going to listen to it when the bank is already robbed.
Yeah. And Jim will be like, oh yeah, we did that. Oh God. I'm actually going to my mama's on Mother's Day weekend. But nice. I need a place down at the lake, so it'll be perfect.
Ooh, that's nice.
Yeah. All right. Well, we are going to skip the whole odd true crime thing, and we're just going to talk about something. We didn't talk about this, I don't think, on our last episode. So we're going to talk about, and then we skipped a week. So we're going to talk about O.J. Simpson dying.
The man who killed his wife.
Yeah. And let's be honest, we all know he did it.
I agree.
The man wrote a book, like, what if I did it? So he pretty much confessed without confessing.
And it's just crazy to me. He really got away with it.
Well, and then my husband told me that supposedly, like, all his family members and people that were in the hospital with them had to sign a non-disclosure mm-hmm. agreement because they knew that he'd be, like, confessing a bunch of shit or whatever, and they didn't want that coming out. I was like, why does it matter? He's fucking dying. Give us the fuck, give her family and her their kids and stuff some closure, you know? Like, shit.
I guaranteed he mentioned it. I just know it.
You know it. You know
it. And it gets under my skin that
I wouldn't have signed it. I would have been like, well, hell no, I ain't signing that shit. It's about time our family moved on, you know? Like, yeah. Damn.
He's going to be dead. It's not going to matter anyways.
I don't know if we'll ever cover that or not because, I mean, it's been covered so many times and there's so many, I mean, we know everything about it, so it's almost mm-hmm. not worth it to cover it, but yeah, who knows? Maybe we will someday.
Maybe.
Another thing we can talk about is how P. Diddy and stuff is starting to come out where connections with the Tupac murder.
Yeah.
And all the other shit that's coming with P. Diddy too. I mean, you know, it's not even just that.
That whole thing, like with P. Diddy just... Oh, the industry is just so dirty.
You know what? The more and more, it just disgusts me, the industry. Like, I was reading this thing this morning about the original Willy Wonka, the one Gene Hackman. You know, the part where he's like, they're in the lickable wallpaper. It's like, it tastes like oranges, tastes like grapes. He's like, and the snozzberries taste like snozzberries. Well, everybody thinks, oh, that's just a fictional thing. No, snozzberries refer to dicks intentionally.
Oh, my goodness.
The writer, Ronald Dahl, who wrote those books, he was a fucking... weird motherfucker. And he did that intentionally. He put that in there intentionally. And this is a children's movie. And they left that in that movie. Like, it's things like that. It's like they're little subtle hints of what the industry is really like.
Yeah. And you don't see it then. But then later down the line, you're like, oh my gosh, are you serious?
I just think that any parent that would put their children in the industry is just stupid. Because there's too much pedophilia and things going on in that industry. And there's not people protecting your children. Unless you're going to be there protecting them. Which I just don't see that's able. I mean, these people are rich and powerful. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's like the Michael Jackson thing. Those people that would just send their kids off with them and stuff. Who mm-hmm. does that? I don't care. Like, I'm not a materialistic person. So the money aspect is not going to be something for me. So I sure the fuck am not going to send my children off with some person I barely know just because we're getting some monetary something out of it.
Yeah, it's pretty disgusting.
So disgusting. Yeah. Ugh. Anyway, so yeah, I'm glad that we're not in that industry, that we're in our podcast industry. So, ugh.
Yeah, you can't trust anybody out there for real.
No, not at all. So that's kind of what we're going to discuss on our banter stuff today. We got a fairly longer episode, I think, so we're going to get into it. It was going to be a short one, but then I found some more, a better website to go off of, so... yeah, we're going to do a little bit better episode than originally planned. So, Jazz, what time is it?
Molly, time to fuck around and find out.
And we're going to do that. And this week, we have a Jazz pick. She picked this one, guys. And I think I might have heard of this guy in passing before, but I didn't really know much about him either. So, I mm-hmm. was excited when you introduced me to somebody that I didn't know about. So, I was like, well, fuck yeah, we'll do this. And this is actually one of those things where... it's a possibility he might not have been the guilty party to. So that's one of those kind of like, kind of situations. And we are covering this week Charles Albright, a.k.a. the Eyeball Killer. But we're going to talk about him in a minute because in this article, it kind of starts out with the crimes. So the Dallas police had no idea what had begun when they collected the body of a murdered prostitute on December 13th, 1990. She was found in plain sight on the 8800 block of Beckley View in the Oak Cliff neighborhood. According to the Dallas Morning News, The kids who first saw her thought they'd stumbled across a mannequin. Everybody always says that.
Every time.
How many mannequins do you know that are just laying around randomly?
Oh, look, a mannequin over there. There's a
mannequin laying there. Instead, it was the nearly nude body of a dark-haired woman lying face up, wearing only a t-shirt, and shot in the back of the head with a .44 caliber bullet. In footage shown on HBO's autopsy program, there was blood on her face and shirt. Detective John Westphalen took over the case and learned from another officer that the victim had been Mary Lou Pratt, 33, a known prostitute who worked that area. On autopsy, the area was described as a hangout for drug dealers, drug addicts, and prostitutes. Matthews and Wicker indicate that Lee Harvey Oswald retreated to a movie theater here after shooting President Kennedy. To the police that day, the murder had just seemed like one of the routine risks, the shady business of prostitution. Yet it was soon discovered that this one went beyond the reactive type of killing from anger or over money. There was something more deviant about it. Dr. Elizabeth Peacock, the medical examiner, was going over the body to ascertain the cause and manner of death when she placed her hands on the dead woman's face and prepared to look at the condition of the eyes. She touched the stiffening lid and pushed it open. To her surprise, she saw only muscle and gore, no eye. In fact, it appeared that the eyeball had been removed with surgical care and not merely gouged out in anger with someone's thumbs. Moving to the other eye, she opened the lid and saw the same thing. This killer had removed both eyes without making much of a mark on the lids and apparently had taken them with him. Fucking creepy.
That is like, oh, I love her eyes. Let me take them out.
It's like, Jeepers, peepers, where'd you get them peepers?
Did you know Jeeper Creepers is actually based on a true story? Like some of, not the flying dude or whatever, but some of the stuff in there is actually based on something that happened in Missouri.
I did not know
I that. Shall send it to you.
I did not know that. Definitely send me that. We don't even have Jeepers Creepers in our thing, do we? Given the bizarre nature, I like the second one best.
Me too.
Just because there's more people in it. So, given the bizarre nature of the crime, Westphalen contacted the FBI's VICAP unit. With their Violent Criminals Apprehension Program, a computerized database that provides details about prior crimes or criminals who may have some predictive association with the one under study. Matthews and Wicker described the report in The Eyeball Killer. Given the apparent ritual involved in the incident, the criminal behavior specialists suggested that the killer had murdered for pleasure and had taken the eyes as souvenirs to help him relieve the erotic sensations of his violence. In a way, of all such killers, eventually the vividness of his memory would diminish, along with the sense of power he had gained, and he likely would seek to renew it. Hence, he would be prowling the streets looking for an opportunity to kill again. The police placed this information in a file. They were aware of the danger, but had no real evidence from the scene to provide any leads. It was rumored that Mary Lou Pratt and another prostitute, Susan Peterson, had ripped off stolen goods from a warehouse belonging to one of their customers. It seemed logical to believe that the man had gotten his revenge, but investigators could not discover who he was. The mutilation was kept from the media, and the back page report of the crime was soon forgotten. The case went cold. While two Hispanic brothers were questioned based on a tip, there was no evidence against them. 2 months passed before the police had reason to think of it again, and when they did, they recalled an incident that had happened around the same time. Veronica, a prostitute nicknamed Flaca, for her unnaturally skinny frame, was familiar to officers John Matthews and Regina Williams, who patrolled as partners along Oak Cliff's Jefferson Boulevard. Matthews would later pin the eyeball killer about the case and his part in helping to solve it. He'd spotted Veronica on at the Star 8 Motel in mid-December, where the street girls often brought customers. She'd looked pretty bad that night, and she told the officers that on the previous evening, a man who had picked her up had tried to kill her. Indeed, he'd raped her. She had a wound on her head to show how brutal he'd been. She had barely escaped, she said, and had hidden from him until she could get to a friend's place for help. Violence was just part of the lifestyle, so there was not much the officers could do for her, nor any reason they should link her incident with that, what had happened to Mary Lou Pratt. But when they saw her in a light blue truck on December 15th and tried to arrest the man, she insisted that he was the one who had saved her from her attacker and ought to be let go. The driver was a man who called himself Speedy. and the address on his driver's license listed a home on El Dorado Avenue, not far from there. He said he and his wife, Dixie, and that he and Veronica were just friends. The officers passed the story on to the homicide unit just in case it proved to be significant in some way. They would eventually have cause to remember it, because on February 10th, 1991, another prostitute, 27-year-old Susan Peterson, was found murdered. Peterson was nearly nude with her t-shirt pulled up to display her breasts in the same manner as Pratt. She'd been shot 3 times in the top of the head, in the left breast and point blank in the black of the head, in the back of the head. One bullet had pierced her heart and another entered her brain. A clump of her hair lay on her chest. She had been dumped in South Dallas, just outside city limits. And the ME found that this victim bore another grisly similarity. Her eyes had been surgically removed. There had been no bleeding, Matthews points out, and only 2 small cuts. So now they knew they had a repeat killer, one who apparently operated from ritual, just as the FBI report had said. Even worse, 2 days before her murder, Peterson had indicated to a patrol officer that she might know who Mary Lou Pratt's killer was. She hadn't offered an identification then, and now that information was gone along with her. It appeared that the offender had taken Peterson to the same place to kill her as he had taken Pratt. That helped to establish what geographical profiles would term his zone of familiarity. He likely lived or worked in the area and was almost certainly a resident of Dallas, rather than a roving stranger passing through town. Matthews and Williams thought about what Veronica had said, and she was still telling the same story about how she had nearly been killed. She was a known liar and generally made little sense, but her consistency made her story more credible. Then she added that she had actually witnessed Pratt being murdered, but she could not identify the house to where she had been taken to the raped and beaten. So she proved to be a useless source. Leads came in from people who had seen or who knew someone who they suspected to be the killer, but nothing panned out. The media soon dubbed the vicious killer the Dallas Ripper. I mean, I kind of like that one too, because he was going after prostitutes and stuff, but he wasn't disemboweling them. So he was only taking their eyes. I feel like if you're going to call somebody the Ripper, they need to be like really mutilating the bodies and stuff. So the third victim, and he only has an apparent 3 victims, possibly 4 or so.
You think there's more?
I don't even know if he's the killer to begin with.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, we'll get into that when we start getting into his story. Right now, we're just kind of talking about
the victims. I got some things to say.
The area hookers and the police believed that the killer was probably white and would therefore only target white prostitutes, as he had done twice already. Special Agent Jed Ray, the FBI supervisor for that region, was on the case. In an interview for HBO, he said that in general, the killers are interracial, they stick with their own kind, but there were rare cases in which they crossed over. Because profiles are based on probabilities, this killer was probably white and any future victims would be as well. Ray knew that the killer he mutilates might have some other strange fetishes as well, such as drinking blood. So it was possible that he had a history of mental instability. Several detectives also believed that the offender had some medical background, but no one could locate a case in which this type of mutilation had occurred before. 2 SWAT cars were assigned to the area to keep watch over the late night activities. Because the first 2 murders had been 2 months apart, they wondered if they might see another such incident in April. But the killer took them by surprise. On March 18th, despite stepped-up police patrols, a black part-time prostitute, Shirley Williams. How are you a part-time prostitute?
I try so hard to take that serious.
So you're a part-time prostitute. You either are or you're not.
I work at a warehouse in the day, but at night I'm a prostitute.
Yeah, no shit. And she was 41 at that. God damn. She was murdered. Her new body was found lying on its side near a school, and blood pulled from her face onto the street. I still can't get over part-time prostitute. She was getting too old, so that's why she did it part-time, I guess. I don't know. The medical examiner who came to the scene rolled back her eyelids, fearing the worst, and discovered that this was the 3rd victim in this series. The eyes were gone. Williams also had facial bruises and a broken nose, probably from being punched. She had been shot through the top of her head and in the face. Again, there were no fingerprints and no semen. If the killer had had sex with these women, he had been careful to use a condom. In fact, an unwrapped condom lay next to the body. But he had not been nearly as careful this time as he removed the eyes. He'd slashed at her face as he did not know quite how to perform this deed. And in the eye socket, he'd broken off the tip of what turned out to be an X-Acto knife. Perhaps he'd been rushed, someone speculated. It had been late when she disappeared. Background check indicated that Williams had been with friends the night before, getting high on drugs. She had also told her daughter that she would be home that night. It was raining at the time, so Williams had put on a yellow slicker. Friends said that she had gotten into a car and that was the last anyone had seen her. Another prostitute identified in Matthew's book as Brenda said that a few evenings before Williams had been murdered, a white man had tried to kill her. She offered a description of an older man with salt and pepper hair who drove a green and brown station wagon. She thought she recalled a mustache and slight beard stubble. His skin had been brownish, but he was not African American. He'd invited her into his car and wanted to take her somewhere to have sex. She'd resisted because she had her own idea of where to go and was careful never to leave familiar territory. That made him angry. He'd shouted about whores doing him wrong and had acted in such a way that she'd felt forced to spray him with mace. But he kept driving, so she jumped from the car while it was still moving. I love that. And that's like the girl in the Robert Hansen case, mm-hmm. where she was a fucking fighter, man.
You go, girl.
Police believed that Williams had been murdered in the area, probably outside somewhere, and that meant her clothing ought to turn up. A yellow slicker would not be difficult to spot, so they set about scouring likely spots to have sex in private, kill, and perform this mutilation. They searched a field about a mile away but came up with nothing. In any event, whether or not she was even his actual target for that night, Shirley Williams was the victim of a serial killer, and one who did not stick with a specific victim type. That would make the investigation more complicated. The Dallas Police Force now had to face this fact, and the FBI got more fully involved. The body, too, is a crime scene, and the criminalists at the lab would go over it with precision instruments to try to collect even some small bit of evidence. They would also look at each piece of potential evidence that police officers picked up from the scene. Criminalist Charlie Lynch took over this aspect of the investigation. He had looked at Williams' body prior to the autopsy and with tape had removed hairs from the back of her neck. He then placed them under a microscope to examine their pattern, shape, and consistency. Different races yield different types of hair, as do different parts of a body. Lynch identified the hair found on Williams as a pubic hair from a Caucasian. That meant it was not from the victim. It wasn't much, and it didn't help the police to track someone down, but it would come in handy once a suspect was identified. And this is early 90s, so this is just when DNA evidence is starting to be something that we can use in cases and mm-hmm. stuff. It's still not, it's not anywhere near to the point of where it is nowadays. Helpfully, the gun that had killed Mary Lou Pratt was identified by the ballistics labs as the same one that had killed Shirley Williams. That was good, because the Williams mutilation could have easily been problematic in court for a linkage analysis. And while a different gun had been used on the second victim, her mutilation was so similar to Pratt's that there would be no trouble claiming those crimes were linked to a single offender. Anyone could have more than one gun. There was nothing unusual about that, especially in Texas. Given three murders in their territory, Matthews and Smith thought about what they'd heard on the streets over the past month and turned their attention to the story that Veronica had told about seeing Mary Lou Pratt murdered. They recalled the man they had stopped, Speedy, and decided to run a check on his address. Yet when they researched it, they found that the property was listed in the name of Fred Albright, who owned some properties near where the first body had been found, but Albright was deceased. That was curious, as was the next thing they learned. A few days earlier, a frightened woman had called a deputy constable to discuss a man named Charles Albright, who was Fred's son. She once had worked in a clothing store at the mall, and Albright, a customer, had come in and frequently given her gifts. Her fellow workers had disliked him, but she had decided to go out with him. She soon had reason to regret that decision, and she considered him to be dangerous. As Matthews and Wicker tell it, Albright revealed to her that he was a professional con man and that he possessed a lot of stolen property. Although he was married, he'd convinced this woman to move into one of his rental properties, where he then came for sex. She said that his demands became weirder until he outright scared her, especially his, especially his obsession with knives and eyes. She moved out, got married, and moved on with her life, but remained afraid, even years later, that Albright would find her and kill her. So the best piece of information she offered was that she was aware that Mary Lou Pratt and Albright had been acquainted. When the officers looked into Speedy's history, it turned out that he had a long criminal record, including a conviction for aggravated assault on a child. Not only that, a woman named Dixie popped up in the records, and the officers recalled that Speedy had said that she was his wife's name. The facts and associations were growing more compelling by the minute. They knew they had to check this guy out. Detective Wes Fallon advised Matthews and Smith to show Brenda some photos to see if she could pick out the man who had picked her up and threatened her. She looked over the collection of mugs and without hesitation pointed to a photo of Charles Albright. The next step was to contact Veronica and show her the photos. She was in prison and it was difficult to get her to cooperate. But in the end, she too selected Albright as her attacker. That was two for two. Good corroboration. Even if these reports were from prostitutes with drug habits, it was time to move on Albright. Only 4 days after Shirley Williams had been brought to the morgue, the police had a warrant in hand for Albright's arrest and a plan to apprehend him. At that time, thanks to the prostitutes, he could be charged with attempted murder and attempted assault. They could hold him and search for better evidence against him in three murders. A couple of hours after midnight on March 22nd, members of the elite tactical squad came together to surround Albright's Oak Cliff home in Eldorado. They spotted a station wagon in the driveway, similar to the one described by Brenda. They called the house to make sure a male was inside, and a man answered. At the signal, they moved in. A window was smashed, and stun grenades were tossed inside. Albright would later complain about this procedure and ask why they hadn't just knocked. I agree.
Like, why? That was unnecessary.
Yeah, I mean, come on. Others broke in through the door and rousted Albright and his wife from bed. Dixie began to scream and demanded to know what they were doing. They asked Albright where Speedy was, but he seemed confused by the question. Later, they realized that, fortuitously, Speedy had simply used Albright's address on his license. He did not live there. Albright and Dixie were hustled off to the police station for interrogation, while investigators searched his house and prepared to look at other properties listed under his deceased father's name. So the Speedy guy is a different guy. Okay. Mm-hmm. One item of interest found in Albright's home was a collection of red condoms. Red condoms? That's kind of gross.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to see that.
Since that same color of condom had been found next to Shirley Williams' body, Albright also had a collection of books about serial killers and some Nazi literature. I mean, not the Nazi literature, but I mean, I have lots of books about serial killers too, so that doesn't really mean that you're a murderer.
Yeah, they're going to be like, what is going on in this house?
According to the autopsy program, but no other source, the results of the search in his home turned up an obsession with dolls and eyeless masks. And Hollinsworth said there was a collection of female Ladro figurines. The HBO producers indicate that the police believe this obsession with dolls was connected with what would be learned about Albright. He had a fascination with eyes. The police also recovered debris from his vacuum cleaner and a collection of guns from his secret hiding place. At first, he said he owned no guns, but caught in a lie, he had told them where to look. One weapon was a Smith & Wesson 44 caliber revolver, the type of gun they were looking for, but they had to test it to be certain it was the murder weapon. At another of Albright's properties, they discovered several X-Acto knives with razor-sharp blades that could have been used to perform the precision surgery done to the victims. In fact, the blade from such an implement had broken off in the third murder victim. At the police station, Wes Fallon questioned Dixie, a former widow, first, and she was aghast that anyone would think that her husband had committed such violent crimes. He was an easygoing guy, liked by everyone. In fact, she offered an alibi. He was in bed with her every night. He did have an early morning paper route, that was true, but he was always in bed when her alarm went off. When confronted with the fact that her husband had a criminal record, she admitted that she had not known about it. She also offered no reason why he would have condoms, since she was past menopause. She'd known about them, but had never questioned him. Stupid bitch.
She definitely is stupid.
Dixie continued to stand by him, but these revelations must have shaken her. In the early morning hours, Wes Fallon finally questioned Albright, who had adamantly denied knowing of any murder victims or any prostitutes, and refused to admit that he had anything to do with murder. He pointed out that his criminal record was for property crimes and offered a plausible story about the sexual assault conviction. He did know Speedy, one of his tenants, but did not know why his address was on the man's driver's license. Later on, Albright's winter Speedy was questioned because he'd been with Veronica and knew something about that assault. He told the police that Veronica had never brought Albright to his place, although they firmly believed that he had. Speedy remained a viable suspect as well, especially by Albright's friends. But Hollinsworth indicates that he hardly seemed a likely candidate for such skill with an X-Acto knife. Speedy insisted that it was not Albright from whom he had saved Veronica, but rather a Hispanic male whom he did not know. Despite his loose association, he was never as a solid suspect as Albright was. But even with him, there were questions. The more the investigators learned about Albright, the less certain they were they had the right guy. He did not fit the profile of a serial killer, and he had an alibi. He had a master's degree, knew several languages, was a former science teacher, was charming, was in a seemingly satisfying relationship, and seemed completely at ease with having his home searched and his gun tested. He did not abuse substances. Associates who were questioned about him remained loyal. Certain the police had the wrong man. Albright had coached football, helped with Cub Scouts, and was kind to children. He was both articulate and artistic, a cultivated man accomplished in many things from piano to bullfighting, who seemed anything but a murderer. He was generous, friendly, and helpful to people in need. He was apparently too old. At 57, he defied the stereotype of the angry young lust killer who was generally in his 20s or 30s. According to what was then known about serial killers, they tended to be loners and losers, taking only menial work and not maintaining relationships for very long. Well, we know differently now. They were undereducated, narcissistic, and often in search of short-term gratification. While Texas had not seen many serial killers until then, and the Dallas police had dealt with none, they knew from the FBI profile what to expect. Albright just did not fit. He claimed the officers would not find a woman who would say he treated her badly. But on the other hand, with more digging, it turned out there was more to Albright after all.
There always is.
Occasionally, someone had a story about Albright's temper. He'd once quit a job over a minor incident. Another time, he commented that he hated prostitutes and wanted to kill them. And it was noted that Albright lived in somewhat parasitic life, as Dixie paid all the bills. He'd inherited a substantial amount of money after his father died, but he'd squandered that. He also clearly had a secretive life, going to prostitutes for years without his wife ever knowing. He'd lied several times during his interrogation, had a record of shoplifting, and was clearly a womanizer. Some people saw him as a smooth operator, stretching the truth and using people for his own gain, but keeping a likable persona as a way to exploit them. So he wasn't squeaky clean, but he also was not what any of the cops would have expected a serial killer to be. I mean, there never are. That posed a problem for the investigation. If they arrested and charged the wrong man, the media, which had already played up the story, would skewer them. Not to mention, such a mistake could give the real killer the opportunity to kill again or leave the area. Yet Albright's background, even filled as it was with accomplishment, supports a possibility of a diagnosis of psychopathy. The manipulative, intelligent charmer who lies easily, exploits others, and honors only himself without remorse for harm he may do to others. Such people are slick and secretive, and even people close to them may be fooled by their facades. Robert Hare has done the most extensive work on the notion of psychopath, devising the psychopathy checklist and revising it in 1985. The PCLR diagnosis is formed from a semi-structured interview with the people assessed, along with information from their files. Hare and his associates clarified a set of diagnostic criteria, characterizing it by such traits as a lack of remorse or empathy, shallow emotions, charm, deception, egocentricity, glibness, and the persistent violation of social norms. They often present themselves as something other than they really are, as a way to manipulate others for their own gain. They're often parasitic. I had a parasite once.
Really?
Dad, yeah. There was little doubt among the police after they learned more about him that Albright had nearly perfected this persona. And he said it himself to the prostitute that he was a con man, so... Matthews and Wicker, as well as Hollinsworth, provide a detailed portrait of Albright's childhood. He was born on August 10, 1933. His mother, Del, and father, Fred, had adopted him from an orphan's home. And it was clear from the start that Del was in control. She was a strict elementary school teacher, and she used that position to shape and form her precious young son. She doted on him and overprotected him, but did not show much outward affection. Bedford et al. Says that she sometimes dressed Charles as a girl and gave him a doll to play with. Other sources confirm this. And Hollandsworth says that she would change him frequently to keep dirt off of him. She also accelerated his education, getting him skipped ahead 2 grades. Whatever he set out to do, he did well. When he was given a gun, Charles killed small animals and told his mother he wanted to be a taxidermist. So she helped him to learn how to skin and stuff his dead birds. His products were lifelike, but he was not allowed to complete them with the glass eyes sold in taxidermy shops because they were too expensive and Del was frugal in the extreme. Instead, she had him use buttons. In other words, eyes were forbidden. He may well have developed his desire to get the eyes that his mother had denied him. In school, although he was a good student, he became a bit of a troublemaker for petty thefts and at the age of 13 was arrested for aggravated assault. He also went to a prostitute during adolescence. By the time he was 15 in 1949, he'd made sufficiently decent grades to graduate from high school, and with the help of forged transcripts, got into North Texas State University, but then his luck ran out. At age 16, the police caught him with some petty cash from a cash register, 2 handguns, and a rifle. For that, despite Dell's strenuous efforts on his behalf, he received a year in jail. Having apparently learned his lesson upon his release, he set out to be a productive citizen, going to Arkansas State Teachers College and majoring in pre-med studies. He also learned several languages. He was popular, but people were aware that he often bragged and exaggerated things about himself, including his bedroom habits. Some people said that it was second nature for him to lie, especially because he claimed to have bedded dozens of women. In subjects he liked, he excelled. But he also took to stealing tests or changing his grades in the school files when he needed to. He got his girlfriend to steal keys for him. He was active on campus in several clubs, but had a reputation for being reckless and perverse. And there was one incident that several publications have mentioned as significant because eyes figured prominently in it. One of his football teammates dated a girl with almond-shaped eyes, and when they broke up, he tossed out the photos and got a new girlfriend. He had a few photographs of himself with this new girl, and one day he noticed something odd. Albright had cut out her eyes, and in their place, he had pasted the almond-shaped eyes of the former girlfriend. Albright had also pasted the eyes in other places, such as the ceiling and bathroom. It was bizarre, but apparently not uncharacteristic of him. Found with stolen items, he was expelled from the college before graduation, but not prosecuted. He wasn't fazed, he just falsified his degrees, stealing the right documents, forging signatures, and giving himself a bachelor's and master's degree that he didn't earn. Sounds a lot like John Edward Robinson, you know what I mean?
Oh, he said, I'm going to get it one way or another.
Yeah. Getting married to his college girlfriend, you know, the one that stole the keys for him, who became a teacher, he took up a seemingly normal life, and they had a daughter. Albright failed to hold a job for long, but whatever he did work at, he mastered. Illustrator, bullfighter, hairstylist, designer, artist, carpenter. He continued to cheat by forging checks and claiming false credentials. And he was caught in his deception while teaching at a high school. But he always managed to get probation for his illegal acts. He learned that a little charm goes a long way. He'd even been a competent teacher. Again, sounds a lot like John Edward Robinson. That charm does go a long way. But his marriage fell apart in 1965. He and his wife separated, finally divorcing in 1974, almost 10 years later. But while his marriage may have ended, his criminal activities did not, in fact. He grew even bolder. Albright was caught stealing hundreds of dollars worth of merchandise from a hardware store and received a 2-year prison sentence. Yet he served less than 6 months before he was out again. He worked hard to become more presentable, converting to Catholicism and inaugurating himself with people from the parish. Ingratiating himself, I'm sorry. When he was 48, his mother, Del, died. Albright went to find his birth mother, whom Del had told him was a married and brilliant law student, and managed to meet her, and she apparently had never been a law student. He would later tell someone that she was a prostitute, although there was no evidence for this. But it does make sense. I mean, he was an orphan, you know. That would also make some sense about having issues with prostitutes.
That's why he wants to kill him.
That same year, while Albright was visiting some friends, he sexually molested their 9-year-old daughter. They reported him and he was prosecuted. Why would you report him? You should have fucking cut his fucking dick off, shoved it down his throat, and then killed his fucking ass. If I found somebody molested one of my fucking kids, that's what would happen. And I would gladly go to jail for it, but I know enough how to dispose of a body at this point.
This is proof.
I don't care. If it's protecting my kids, you can use this against me. I don't fucking care.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. He later claimed that he was innocent, but had fled to avoid a hassle. Still, it went on his record and would come to haunt him in later years. He was now a sexual predator. During those years, according to prostitutes in town, he frequented their hangouts and paid them well, most likely from the money he had inherited from his father's death. A friend admitted that he'd known about Albright's thefts and said that many of the gifts he gave out were items he had stolen. Then in 1985, Albright met Dixie in Arkansas. After his father's death, he invited her to come and live in his home. It wasn't long before she was paying the bills from her menial job, even taking out a loan to do so. She accepted Albright's excuses for not working, spite his intelligence and accomplishments, and let him con her into taking care of him. The one concession he made was to take on a paper route that sent him out into the streets during the early morning hours. That may well have been so that he could continue to visit prostitutes without raising her suspicions. Alfred Jones, Albright's juvenile probation officer from decades earlier, told Westphalen that Albright had a way of not facing up to reality or responsibility. He had his own sense of values and he could lie so easily that he convinced himself he was telling the truth. In other words, like many psychopaths, according to the theory offered by Al C. Carlyle, Albright compartmentalized. He did what he needed to deflect others from his secrets and set up different sets of values for different life frames. His secret life grew darker and more perverse because there was no accountability, save to his ideas and addictions. But the morality for his acts was entirely of his own making. The murder cases seemed to be falling apart. Investigators who searched were unable to find evidence that any murders had been committed at Albright's house, and they did not find bloody clothes or shoes, although they found socks and underwear soaking in bleach. Worse, his .44 Magnum tested negatively as the gun that had killed Mary Pratt and Shirley Williams, and Dixie had supplied garage receipts to prove that their cars had broken down and were thus unavailable at the time of the first two murders. Still, there was circumstantial evidence they could use, and they were able to detain him on the charge of attempted murder while they continued to build a case. In Speedy's house, for example, they found a stash of pornographic magazines along with a structure that allowed for the practice of autoerotic sexual asphyxiation, semi-strangulation to achieve a more powerful orgasm. As landlord, Albright had a key, so they looked hard for evidence that he used the place when Speedy was away. Veronica had mentioned this place, and Officer Matthews believed that Albright came here to carry out secretive activities. There was also evidence from hair analysis. The police had confiscated blankets from Albright's trucks and sent them to Charlie Lynch in the lab. Along with the debris from Albright's vacuum, the blankets had hair and fibers, and so did the debris. In fact, from the vacuum, they isolated some hair that was consistent with Shirley Williams as African American. There were not enough strands to perform the type of DNA analysis that was used at the time. So like I said, it was still, nowadays they could take a little tiny piece of hair and do an analysis on it. But back then you had to have so much to be able to do it. Albright agreed to let the police take hair and blood samples from him. And Lynch soon called Westphalen to tell him that hair found on one of the bodies was consistent with Albright's hair samples. In addition, hair found on the blankets from his truck appeared to match hair from the prostitutes. As good as that sounded, hair was considered class evidence, not unique evidence. In other words, a strand of hair might be consistent with hair from a victim or suspect, but it could not be proven with certainty to have originated with that person. Nevertheless, on March 26, District Attorney filed capital charges against Albright in the deaths of Mary Pratt, Shirley Williams, and Susan Peterson. The court appointed Brad Lohler as Albright's attorney. It wasn't a slam dunk case by any stretch, so investigators knew they'd have to work much harder to find a way to pin the murders on Albright. Then another prostitute offered an interesting report. Mary Beth was in prison. She told the police that she knew Albright and she didn't much care for the memory. On December 13th, the same night on which Mary Lou Pratt had been killed, Mary Beth had been standing outside a motel. Suddenly, a man had grabbed her and put a knife to her throat, forcing her into a car and slapping her in the face. She tried to struggle, but had been unable to fight him. She remembered that he had driven her out to a field and thrown her onto a blanket there. He kept hitting her and punching her. Then she said he opened a case and she'd seen that it had a collection of metal cylinders with sharp pointed blades attached to them. He'd reached for one and used it to cut open her blouse. He then discarded the blade and got another one to make another cut. At that point, she had passed out from fear, and when she came to, he was gone. With this story, investigators believed they could find more, so they set about interviewing other prostitutes in the area. Tina, who had beautiful eyes, also had a story to tell. She said that she had once dated Albright. For the most part, he'd been polite and good to her until the last time they'd gone out. They'd been in his truck, and he'd threatened her quite a bit rougher than usual. She'd run from him then and had seen him again on the night that Shirley had died. Albright had driven by them, and Tina had gotten into another car, so she did not actually witness Albright pick Shirley up. But when she got back, Shirley was gone. She showed the police the field where Albright had often taken her, and a search turned up an old blue blanket, some condoms, and a crumpled yellow raincoat, like the one that Shirley had been wearing the night she disappeared. It had blood on it that was a significant find. This was just more circumstantial evidence, to be sure, but the more the better, especially when it was this specific. How many people wore those yellow rain jackets? In addition, Willie Upshaw, to whom Albright had written a number of checks and who was serving time for an illegal possession of a firearm, said that Albright had another .44 caliber weapon that the police had not found. They discovered that he'd purchased it in his father's name. Unless they found the weapon, they could prove nothing, but its absence was suggestive. Upshaw had also been with Albright on the day in March when his car had broken down, and it was his contention that Albright did have a car that night Shirley was killed. In addition, the police search had turned up several stolen cars, so Albright could easily have used one of those. There was a sufficient amount of information and evidence to move forward toward a grand jury hearing. The charges against Albright shifted and changed it as the prosecutors prepared for trial. First, three murders were attributed to him, and then the unsolved 1988 stabbing murder of an Oak Cliff area prostitute based on several strands of hair found on her that were consistent with Albright's, although her eyes had not been removed. Now, mind you, this happened before the other murder, so it could have been his first one, you know, and he just didn't get to that point yet, but I don't know. Then Albright came up with an alibi for that one. He was out of town, so that charge was dropped. Given the type of evidence available, a grand jury reduced the capital murder charges to murder, so the death penalty was off the table. And eventually, the district attorney's office settled on prosecuting Albright for only one murder, Shirley Williams, without explaining why they were doing so. The judge said that should they lose, they could not reinstate the other charges for later cases. It wouldn't matter. The Williams case was their strongest one, and if they lost that, they would surely lose the others too. The judge knocked down the bond to $750,000, but Albright could not afford that any more than the original $3 million, so he remained in prison. Thus, when his trial date was finally set for December 2nd, 1991, Albright faced prosecution for the murder of Shirley Williams, which carried a sentence of life in prison. However, the court ruled that the prosecution could bring in the other cases based on the linkage. Once the legal issues were worked out, the trial initially delayed began. Dan Hagwood, Toby Shook, and Mike Bosili made up the prosecution's team, and among their star witnesses were the two patrol officers who had followed their instincts and linked together the prostitutes who'd complained about Albright. Prosecution had a theory that Albright had become enraged after two prostitutes, one of them Pratt, had ripped him off one night. A prostitute who had been with Albright and Susan Peterson, the second victim, testified about how he had picked them up together one night and beaten them severely. In fact, he had handcuffed the witness and beaten her with an electric cord for half an hour. Albright also had enormous gasoline bills, ostensibly from cruising. On December 7th, Special Agent Judd Ray testified about the linkage analysis and the fact the killer would have been comfortable and familiar with the Oak Cliff area. In many different sources, he is quoted as saying, What was interesting to us was the method in which these victims, these body parts were taken. In my professional opinion, it's doubtful that you would have more than one person that deranged living in this city. So after a day of deliberation on December 18th, the jury returned their verdict. Charles Albright was found guilty of Shirley Williams' murder. He received a sentence of 5 years to life, and his attorney promised to appeal. Lohler insisted that an innocent man had been convicted. Albright was sent to the Clements Unit of the Texas Department of Corrections in Amarillo. Albright's attorney appealed the case based on lack of evidence against him for the murder conviction. He also said the trial court erred in not conducting a separate hearing on punishment. In 1994, the Texas Court of Appeals, 5th District, published an opinion in which they dismissed Albright's first point of error. Said that the appellant had provided nothing for review on the second issue, and they overruled the third point of error. Because the issue had not been raised in the court, in fact, the judge had pronounced a sentence after Albright's attorney agreed that there was no reason not to. Albright never objected to it when it occurred or when he made a motion for a new trial. His objection in this appeal, then, was not considered timely as required by law. The final sentence of the published opinion was, "We uphold the trial court's judgment." Albright's friends agree, many of who have known Albright for years, but were nevertheless entirely unaware of his criminal record or dealings with prostitutes. They still think that Speedy is the true offender and that a miscarriage of justice have taken place. So he still has plenty of people that support him as being innocent. In the Dallas Morning News, before the trial began, it was reported that Albright was a suspect in two other murders as well, both in Arkansas. Nothing ever came of those cases. And he was in Arkansas for a while because that's where he met Dixie. Mm-hmm. Currently, Albright resides at the Clements Unit of Texas Departments of Corrections in Amarillo. He no longer corresponds with Dixie, and Matthews and Wicker state that he's been observing showing interest in news reports that indicate eyes have been gouged out or cut. Many of the available books on serial killers fail to list this offender. Eric Hickey includes him as a paraphilic serial killer, but without Matthew's book and Hollinsworth article from which Hickey takes his material, Albright might not have surfaced beyond local Texas sources. Hollinsworth and Hickey add that in prison, Albright subscribes to a magazine about erdology and possesses the first issue of Omni magazine from 1978, which features a large eyeball on the cover of HBO's Autopsy series. Adds that he spends his time drawing eyeballs and decorating his prison cell with them. They showed footage of him in the act of drawing an eye with his eyeball artwork pasted to the wall of his cell.
Ain't no way.
Yes. Okay, so he died in 2020 at the age of 87. So August 22nd, 2020, and he was still in prison when he died. But you see what he looks like?
Let me see.
He's got like that hair that... where it's the black hair, but then it's got like the white streaks on the sides and the... Whatever, but kind of a interesting look. Yeah. I mean, he's not the most attractive man right now in his old age, but you can tell that when he was younger, he was probably semi-attractive.
Yeah, so I'm going to say probably, he doesn't look too bad.
That's probably why, I mean, if he's somebody's cup of tea like that, you know, he's not necessarily me or yours cup of tea, but we can also recognize that he's not bad.
Yeah, he's not ugly.
He's not no John Edward Robinson. Because
that's the first person that popped into my head, too. I was like, what?
Yeah, we always come back to him, don't we? Because, I mean, he was our first, so... But, I mean, I guess he explained why he is somewhat of a womanizer. He does look like the type. Okay, so let's discuss that. What do you think? Do you think he is the killer?
I do think he's the killer. But I do too. I do think he's the killer, but something, like, I just can't get away from Speedy. Something's not right with it. Like,
I don't know, with that guy, I don't think that he... was complicit in the killings per se.
But knew.
But I think that maybe he probably helped him with victims and helping to cover up and finding prostitutes that would be easy, you know, easy prey, stuff like that. Kind of like the that one guy, Willie Picton or whatever, that we covered. Like he had people that helped him, you know, bring his victims and stuff to him. So, yeah, we have covered him, haven't we?
I wonder...
We've covered Picton, haven't
we? I think so.
I think so.
You're asking the wrong person. Remember we was at work? Yeah.
We had this big argument the other day. And you know what? I think I'm going to do him next week because it brought it more in my forefront. Yeah. But Luca Minotta which is a serial killer in Canada. And he is on that documentary, which you haven't watched. Watch it. It's called Don't Fuck With Cats. Uh-huh. It's a great fucking documentary.
That you put me on.
Yes. And we've mentioned him a couple times in podcasts because he has a connection to the Barbie and Ken killer. And, you know, we've mentioned him before. And Jasmine at work the other day, she swore up and down. She's like, yeah, yeah, look, I'm not. I was like, yeah, I want to cover him. So she's like, we've been covering him. I'm like, no, we haven't, Jazz. Yes, we have. I'm like, no, we haven't. She's like, I swear we have. $5 we have. I was like, okay, I bet. I automatically took that bet. So I went to our Buzzsprout and I went through all the episodes. Sure enough, we haven't covered them, guys. Yeah. I was like, I do all the research, Jazz. I know who we haven't and haven't covered.
And I lost $5, so I'm upset.
No, I told her, I said, don't worry about it. But I was teasing her the whole day. I'm like, where's my $5?
And true story. My, what is it? Cash App was messed up. It's like going through some shit right now.
She's quick, but she's sending too much money out, man. They're trying to save her ass. Like, hey, bro, you shouldn't be taking this much money out. Yeah. Like, are you good?
Yeah. You good? I was like, okay, let me calm down. I called the bank. She was like, well, yeah, you spent over $2,000 within the last week. I was like, oh, well, okay, never mind.
So, a lot of banks will be like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, right. And especially an online bank. Mm-hmm. So.
But what do you think he did with the eyes?
I know, because they were never found. I
bet you he ate them.
I don't know. I think that if he did keep the, I think he kept them. Mm-hmm. And I think that he had them preserved somewhere, but there's no telling where, you know? I don't think he ate them. I really don't.
I just want to know, like, it bugs me. Like, when I was reading the book about it, I was like, where are
I do know eyes? From Naked and Afraid, though, that the eyeballs are actually, like, a really good source of salt.
Oh, my God.
Because they, like, they eat the eyeballs of the alligators, and it's like, this is good for you because you're not getting the salt, which is something that your bodies need.
Yeah.
And so, to eat the eyeballs, it gives them that salt content that they need.
Ugh. Don't go around eating eyeballs.
Don't go chasing waterfalls. Anyway. Don't go eating eyeballs. That actually goes good.
It does.
Anyway, yeah, I mean, I agree too. I definitely think that he killed them. But I think that he had an accomplice in some capacity. So, yeah. For sure.
I mean, if he probably didn't cut the eyeballs out, he would have had a greater chance of getting away with this, I think.
Maybe.
It was just too obvious with he was obsessed with eyes.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it happened in the 90s, and things were a little bit better with law enforcement by that point. So,
yeah.
They didn't just blow off the killing of prostitutes at that point. So, like they tended to do before. Mm-hmm. The lesser dead. So, all right, you guys. So that is Jazz Picks this week. I think she did good. She did good there because it's more of an obscure case. Like I said in the end of that article, he doesn't really pop up in a lot of serial killer stuff. So a lot of people don't even know he exists, including myself. She happens to be reading this pretty cool like serial killer book, and she came across it. And she's like, hey, have you heard of this guy? We should cover him. I was like, all right, let's do it.
There's so many good people in that book. I'm just like, what the heck?
Well, a lot of them we're already going to cover.
Yeah,
anyway.
Most of them are very like popular.
Yeah, the famous ones. But I mean, there's so many fucking killers out there. Shit.
Yeah, it is. It's scary.
Lordy, lordy. All right, you guys, if you'd like to contact us, you can do so at
3wpodcast2022@gmail.com.
Follow our social on TikTok and Instagram, both at
3W Podcast.
Like our Facebook and discussion group, both at
Wild Wicked World.
And don't forget our X page, guys. You can find us there under
3W Podcast 2022.
All right, guys. Let's not murder prostitutes and cut their eyes out, okay? Just be decent humans. Okay, bye-bye now. All right, now a little about our first ever sponsor, helping us to get this show a-going, Let's Move KC. Not only is this a family-owned business by my cousin Morgan and her husband Brett, my oldest son also worked for them the summer after he graduated high school. With over 20 years of professional moving and storage experience, they are proud to be a family-owned and operated business right here in the KC metro area. Their services range anywhere from local moving to interstate moving, packing and unpacking, one item or whole household and storage is available upon request. They offer specially moving services as well. Piano, baby grand, upright, and spine. Safes, hot tubs, or any other unique thing you may have.
They are fully insured and offer additional insurance upon request. Their main goal is to make sure you feel comfortable and safe in a stressful time like moving by handling your personal stuff like it was their own. Whatever you need, whatever your need is, they can make it happen. So if you're about to move, and this goes for any of our listeners in any states, they're a moving service for any size in any state. Check them out at letsmovekcmovers.com or check them out on Facebook under the name Let's Move KC.